Welcome to the Uplifters podcast, where every week we talk to a woman who's doing big, brave things in the world and who shares that inevitably she has the same doubts and fears and worries that we all do. But just like us, she's learning how to move through them and do big, brave things anyway. Today, we are talking to a true uplifter, Melissa Avalos Ramos. She is the chancellor of New York City Public Schools, which is the largest school system in the entire nation. She started her career as an English teacher and an NYC teaching fellow in the Bronx. We're going to look at what it's like to be the first Latina and the youngest to lead this extraordinary system, but also her journey from student to the leader and influencer of the success of so many students. Chancellor, thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you for that awesome introduction.
I mean, I have to say, stories like yours strike me on so many levels. We have a tendency as humans, and especially as women, to feel limited by our circumstances and to believe that where we are is where we will always be. And without evidence to the contrary, that's all we have to go on. But stories like yours that show how someone who is, I believe you were the first to graduate college in your family?
High school.
The first to graduate high school.
Yeah. In my immediate family, yes.
Extraordinary. And to show that from that place, without role models showing you that this is just what happens, everybody graduates high school. You not only graduated, but continued to carve a path for yourself that allowed you to take your lived experience and turn it into powerful and positive impact for others. Stories like yours are vital to all of us in unlocking our own sense of potential. So can you take us back all the way to the beginning? You grew up in the Bronx.
Yep, I did. I am the daughter of a single mom, Puerto Ricana, who came to the States when she was very, very young. She was still a child. And my journey really starts with her childhood journey. So she was growing up in a very abusive home. My grandmother did not have much, and she remarried, and that put the family in a very abusive situation. And so to get my mother out of there, since she was the eldest of five, she married her off when she was 15 years old to someone who was like 10 or 11 years older than she was, and really believed that that was going to give her a better life. And so my mom was pulled out of school, has nothing but a ninth grade education, no GED. But my mom sacrificed so much to raise three kids, and both my brother and sister ended up getting GEDs as well because the public school system really failed them. In the South Bronx, the quality of public education was not there because during those times, your zip code mattered. And so she sacrificed to put me in Catholic school, and that stayed with me so deeply because my mother shouldn't have had to make those sacrifices. Mm-hmm. To give me that kind of education. So yes, first in my immediate family to get a high school diploma and then to get a college degree. And I dedicated myself to public education because I don't want a parent to have to make that kind of sacrifice. I think parents should do whatever's best for their families. Education is education, and it's very personal, and people have to enroll their children in schools that are best for them. But what's not okay is that the neighborhood school in your backyard is not a wonderful option.
Mm-hmm. I agree completely.
So it started there.
The school you were in, what was missing there?
It was the sink or swim type of situation. No one asked why you don't have a coat. No one asked why you're absent. No one asked why you're tired. It was very punitive. Like, you're not focusing. You're not doing your work. And then as the absences accumulated and my brother and sister got older, it turned into those conversations of, you know, maybe you should move on. Maybe you should get a GED. Maybe you should just go to work. And my brother and sister are extremely bright. And I don't say that because they're my siblings, because I love to poke fun at them and tell them all kinds of, I make fun of their Spanish. I'm a horrible younger sister, but they are brilliant. My brother actually ended up becoming a police officer and retired a second grade detective. And so I always credit my mom for having so little and making sure that she raised just three really successful adults despite not having much. But the school system was merely reading, writing, arithmetic, and didn't ask questions about what was going on in the family. Mm-hmm. And to me, schools have to be these holistic support centers that really pay attention to everything happening in the child's life. And by extension, being a family and working with families to make sure that we're cutting through some of the issues that plague families, particularly minoritized ones and impoverished communities, and work to support families so that way children can actually get the education that they're deserving of.
I love that. And it seems like part of the delta is that they were putting the blame on your siblings for circumstances that were out of their control instead of supporting them.
Yeah. Like my sister, she was working at Dunkin' Donuts when she was in high school, and that was the only food we had. So I was like a really chunky kid, and everybody thought I was just eating a lot. And really, it's because whatever was thrown out in the dumpster, she would bring it home, and that's how we would survive. And so she would go to school exhausted, and sometimes she wouldn't go to school and would stay home and take care of me if my mom had to go to appointments for public assistance, and the school didn't care, right? And that's not okay. We can't have those kinds of conditions for our young people.
Oh, the irony, too, that they were probably labeling her as lazy.
Absolutely. Lazy. And she was one of the hardest.
And she was working harder than anyone.
Exactly.
Yeah. Incredible. As you entered your roles in education, whether as a teacher or a principal, how did you start to get more understanding of the children and the context they were living in order to better support them?
Yeah, that's such a great question. So I studied English literature at Fordham, and my concentration was on medieval literature. So my mother was trying to figure out what I was going to do with that degree.
Fair question.
She was really scared, but I turned out okay. So when I walked into my first classroom, I really thought that I was going to talk about King Arthur and that we were going to read Chaucer and Milton and Shakespeare. And many of my students didn't know how to read and they were acting up. And I quickly realized that the reason they were acting up is not because they couldn't think and they didn't have original ideas, but because they didn't have the skills to really bring their thoughts into the light of the classroom, right? And so I quickly went from being a literature teacher to a literacy teacher. And I would spend a lot of time after school with other teachers. As a matter of fact, one of them became one of my best friends and my future assistant principal when I became a principal in a school. And we launched like a literacy program in the school and wrote our own curriculum. And it was just an amazing experience to spend time with young people and hear the things that kept them from academia, right?
Yeah.
But they were brilliant and they just needed to have a safe space that allowed for them to catch up on these skills, the skills that would amplify the thoughts and the creativity and the innovation that already existed. And I think conveying that to young people and saying, I'm not pouring brilliance into you. I'm merely giving you the tools you need to exercise agency and to talk about all of the amazing ideas that you have is the shift in my success when I became a better teacher. That first year was a little rocky. So it started there. And I still keep in touch with many of those students. As a matter of fact, when I became chancellor, they were just lighting up social media and texting me. And I just helped two of them get jobs and introduce them to the system. To me, those relationships with kids are so important because it keeps you grounded. You really needn't ask what your why is when you stay connected to them and their families. Mm-hmm. And it's very easy to figure out what to prioritize in a very big job with a lot of competing priorities.
That's such an interesting point. I want to go back to this idea of self-belief and helping them believe in themselves. And I think about this with my own children. They've had teachers who didn't foster self-belief, and they've had teachers who have fostered self-belief. On both sides, it's transformative. So what did you notice your teachers were doing that either made you feel like you had potential and you were worthy of believing in yourself and being believed in those who didn't?
So I had a very traditional Catholic school experience up until the seventh grade. It was rough because the Catholic school nuns are not to be messed with. And so I learned a lot of grammar and math, but I was always taught facts and I regurgitated them on exams and I got good grades. And the goal was just to make mom proud and get really good grades. Mm. It wasn't until I got to the seventh grade that I had teachers who fostered that critical thinking. And I'll never forget, I talk about her in a lot of interviews. I hope she sees this somewhere. I have to get in touch with her. Her name is Natalie Ryder. She was my seventh grade English teacher. And then shortly thereafter, I had Mr. Matt Mahoney. And these two teachers referred to me as a writer. When I would say I wanted to grow up to be a writer or a journalist, they said, you already are. And really walking me through the writing process and giving me an opportunity to create original pieces and the way they celebrated me, but also gave me feedback to move me along. It wasn't just that, that's great. They were really involved with the writing process. That's when I not only developed a deep love for writing, but also saw myself as a future English teacher.
Yeah. And it's interesting too, because it sounds like that gap was filled by your mother in those early years. And through her actions, she was showing that she believed in you. And that gave you perhaps the energy and the motivation to act like somebody who is worthy of belief.
Yeah, for sure.
And then the teachers were able to build on that. And I do think that's really ultimately what every child needs, is they need somebody to say, you're worthy of belief and our confidence. And I love that your story is about writing. Specifically, I'm on the board of H6NYC, and our mission is to help children tell their stories and teach them writing skills, because no matter where our school systems are, I think it's hard to find time to foster that in every student. And so we have the great honor of being in many of the schools and being a second source of support for that. And
I love that.
It's life-changing.
Yeah.
And we all have a story. So knowing what it is and how to tell it is what allows us to live our story. So going back to your story, as we mentioned, we're the first. You were the youngest. Mm-hmm. When you were in these situations, did you experience the doubts and fears? Did that hit you? Or were you just like, here's the problem, I'm just going to tackle it?
So it was both. I think there were times when I would say, what am I doing? I'm exhausted. Mm-hmm. I don't belong. Especially when I went to Fordham University and I saw students who had so much more money than I did. And I tell the story of when I sat in one of my seminar classes and I kept saying Antigone instead of Antigone. Mm. And I was last out of class and I didn't go back and I failed. And I kept handing in my papers. I would email my professor, but I refused to walk into the classroom because I was mortified. And then sitting in an American pluralism class and someone said, well, you know, quotas, I mean, this is why certain people are in the classroom. And she kind of just like motions with her arm. And I said, wow, she's talking to me. And so those were some hard years. Mm-hmm. And I remember thinking to myself, I could just go get a job. I don't have to do this. And then I would quickly remind myself that if I didn't want to be in the same situation my mom was in, or even that my brother and sister, they accomplished so much, but they both had to work so hard and couldn't fall back on something because they didn't have the college degree, right? And my brother would always tell me, I'm so lucky I got into NYPD, but like, what would I be doing if I didn't? I would have been a truck driver, and nothing wrong with these careers, but like, I didn't have options, right? And you want to have options. And it was because of that, that I kept going. But feeling like I didn't belong, feeling like I was exhausted and I couldn't do anymore, those were very real things throughout my young adulthood.
When you thought about what a life well lived might look like, what did you imagine?
So funny. I would imagine having a little home and a husband or partner and a child, and not worrying about coming home and seeing an empty fridge, or, you know, that you were getting evicted, knowing that you were going to have a paycheck and security. So I remember saying to myself, if you could just become an English teacher and just get a solid job and be okay, I didn't even dare to dream bigger than that.
Yeah.
And then I remember becoming an English teacher, and my principal and my assistant principal, Sana Nastor and Dina Ravel, they just believed so much in me early in my career. And I said, wait, maybe I could be more than a teacher. maybe I should go get a license to be a principal. Like maybe someday I could be an administrator. And it just kept going from there. But it was people believing in me when I didn't mm-hmm. believe in myself that really fueled that confidence that I needed.
Yeah, that seems like the through line from literally day one.
Yeah.
And so you said something as you were talking about how to decide what to do in the school system and what to prioritize. And this is a massive system with sort of unfathomable complexity. So how do you choose and how does it relate to how you were making choices in the classroom?
Well, I see myself first and foremost as a teacher, and my daughter is a New York City public school student. So I think about what things feel like as a teacher and what they feel like as a student and what do they feel like for our parents. And there are a lot of different initiatives that look really great in the headlines, but if the implementation is not impacting children in a positive way, and if families don't know how to access these resources and initiatives, then all we're doing it is for a headline. And I certainly don't want to be a part of something like that. And so for me, when I have to navigate those spaces, it's what is going to have direct impact on our kids and our families? What is going to support them holistically? What is going to give them access to incredible instruction and curricular materials so their mom doesn't have to sacrifice the way my mom did? How do we make parents partners? How do we empower them? We talk a lot about engagement, but I think engagement has meant in the past that we just check them off and notifying them of what we're doing for and with their kids, as opposed to bringing them to the decision-making table and saying, what do you think about these policies and practices? And what do you want us to consider as we're implementing and rolling out? So that to me has to be a priority. And then the last piece is making sure that we have inclusive spaces for all children. If a child is coming to school not feeling loved, welcomed, we say tolerated. I can't stand that. I don't want to be tolerated. I want to be loved and accepted and celebrated for who I am and all of my complexity and flaw. And I want that for our kids. I want that for my daughter. I want that for every kid in New York City. And so whenever I'm making a decision and I'm launching something or I'm making a decision whether to continue with something, that's kind of the thought process I go through.
That's really beautiful. If you have a vision and you want to create it, it's really easy to get caught up in the details, what it's going to look like, what it's going to sound like, and try to design something based on an imaginary archetype. But what I hear you doing is really focusing on what it's going to feel like. And in my work, I have found time and time again that that is what is successful in terms of realizing the vision, but impactful in terms of achieving the aims. I imagine that that makes it a lot easier to enlist the community that needs to make the dream a reality, because it is both the administration that you alluded to, but it's also these even more active and engaged groups, the teachers, the students, the parents.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And this act of co-creation. What do you feel like you have been able to do in your work that has most directly achieved that impact of true loving acceptance?
I am super proud of the Project Open Arms work. I'll never forget when former First Deputy Dan Weisberg, who just retired and love and miss him so much, I was working for him. He was my boss. And he came to me and said, we're hearing about these buses coming in with a lot of folks from Venezuela. And I don't know how long this is going to last, but I think this is something that you can take on and help us figure it out. And after the second citywide meeting with other commissioners, obviously I wasn't the commissioner, but I was the designee. I went back to him and said, I think this is bigger than we thought. I think we're looking at some unprecedented numbers. And that's when we launched Project Open Arms and wrote the blueprint on how to welcome, enroll, support. And that was such meaningful work because I got to see the system citywide. I was going to schools, collecting best practices, sharing them with schools that necessarily didn't have those practices in place because they hadn't welcomed so many students in temporary housing or didn't have students in temporary housing prior to this. And also connecting with families. I mean, some of them were scared to enter into the shelter system. So they were living in campers and, you know, knocking on doors and convincing them that these were safe spaces for them, answering some of their questions. Some of them would text me on WhatsApp and ask me questions. And so I just got to know the city in a way that I never had before, because I was so school and district based. My entire career was in the same district. I lived there. I worked there. My kid went to school there. It was the whole thing. So this was eye-opening for me. And I'm super proud of that work. Of course, I'm proud of New York City Read Solves and what we recently launched with New York City Public Schools Cares and the support that we're giving families and empowering them to be advocates, not only for their own children, but for other children. But there's one thing that it's going to sound silly, but I'm so proud, because in the past, kids don't know who the chancellor is. They're just like, what is a chancellor? Who is a chancellor? I don't know. And I walked into an event. It was a community event. It wasn't even a school-based event. And this little girl, who couldn't have been more than 8 years old, she said, "That's Melissa Villas-Ramos. She is the chancellor." And she ran to me and gave me the biggest hug. And I'll never forget thinking, my kids know who I am. Mm-hmm. And downstairs, there was a prom going on, and the seniors were like, "Hey, Chancellor, come take a picture with us and dance with us." And I was like, my kids know me. And that was so out of everything that I'm proud of, that told me, like, I really accomplished that goal of being accessible as a mom and as a teacher to my kids and my families.
Yeah. Accessible. And it sounds to me as though they saw you as their champion.
Yes.
And so you are giving that self-belief. How many students are there in New York City?
Almost a million.
Almost a million. Like Uber mom.
Uber and I call teacher. Them my kids. I do.
Yeah. Almost a million children that you get to invest belief in.
Yes.
Yeah. And how wise to focus your energy on the people who most directly filter their energy and time into the students themselves. And so if the teachers feel loved and accepted and cared for, they will be better able to provide that to the students. And how meaningful that is in terms of its ripples into families and communities and the city and the state and the country and the world, really, right? Like, yeah. if you step back and think about the progressive impact of that, it's pretty mind-boggling.
Yeah.
So you've been in your new role for a few months now. It can take a while.
Like inching to a year.
Oh my gosh. A lot's happened. What are you feeling proud of in this new role?
I am feeling proud of New York City Reads and Solves. And I was one of the key architects when Chancellor Banks launched those initiatives. And when the mayor and David tapped me to be his successor, I remember a lot of people were very nervous that I was going to do what other chancellors did, which is kind of just turn the tables over and start from scratch. And I made that promise to New York City and said, I'm not doing that. Like, we have some good stuff going on, but the devil's in the detail. We need to make sure that we're doing the implementation well. And if I'm being honest, there were some hiccups with Reads and Solves, less with Reads, more with Solves. And because of my experience as a teacher and a principal, I was able to work really closely with the unions and make sure that our team was making the adjustments that are necessary. And my deputy chancellor, Donica Rux, and her team have been incredible in helping to move that work. But I think people doubted us. They thought that things were going to fall apart with so much transition. And not only did we keep the train moving, but those test scores went up, 7.2 increase in reading, 3.5 in math. That's nothing to sneeze at. Our kids did amazingly well. Our teachers did phenomenal work. Our school leaders really set the conditions for everyone to be successful. There's still a lot of work to be done, because some of the numbers are still, I mean, to be less than 50% proficient in reading and math in our Black and Hispanic populations, that is unacceptable. But we saw the greatest growth in those two populations that have historically not performed well at all. And so we're starting to see that gap close a little bit. And I'm very proud of it, because as the mother of a little brown girl who struggled with reading and math herself and still continues to have some of those issues coming out of COVID, it is definitely my charge to make sure that we're doing all that we can to help our children.
I've heard in your story so many different ways that you collect data to help inform your priorities. You get into the rooms. You ask a lot of questions. You look at numerical data. Tell me more about where you're collecting insights to understand what's working and what isn't and what really needs your attention.
Yeah. So I have this amazing dashboard that my team created, and little nerdy me logs on every single morning and checks it from attendance to number of incidents and suspension. And then I can disaggregate by district and school and I can see all the things. But quite simply, the most powerful data collection happens in schools, and those qualitative data and those organic conversations with teachers and with school aides and with cafeteria workers and safety agents, and hearing directly from the people on the front lines. I hosted a listening tour as soon as I became chancellor, and some critics were like, why are you listening? You've been in the system almost 20 years. You should know this. But again, right? Every position gives you a different outlook, and chancellor is a pretty big one, yeah. And it's a very privileged seat. And I wanted to make sure that I was listening to kids and families from all different walks of life. I launched a policy team. So I have this policy and strategy team that they come with me to these listening sessions, and they host focus groups with advocates and parents and kids, and they log all the low inference data, and they codify it, and they identify themes and trends and patterns. And then that kind of gives us our marching orders in terms of working with legislators and advocates and with City Hall, and what do we budget for, what needs more resources, what needs more support. So it's comprehensive, but I believe that qualitative data and quantitative data are equally important. And it's not enough to just talk to people. You have to have a system to capture and then to then triangulate and figure out how to move forward.
Yeah, I believe in that so deeply. And it's funny, you took me back as I was listening to very, very early in my career, the first time I met with an executive vice president, and it felt very fancy and very intimidating. And he took notes while we talked. And I had this overwhelming sense of, oh, I'm being heard.
Yeah.
And I say to companies all the time that the worst thing is to ask somebody's opinion, but then do nothing with it.
Bingo.
And it's better not to ask than to ask and ignore. And so I love your approach there because it demonstrates real listening and deep interest.
Thank you.
So you're the chancellor, you're in this great big job with all of this influence, and yet you're still a human being. So what are you, we talk about building courage capital, so sort of building more self-belief to do the next big thing. What are you raising courage capital to do next?
I would say that I have to build courage capital every single day in this job. And what I mean by that is I didn't realize, since I was Chancellor Banks's chief of staff, I saw how people interacted with him. He's this big, charming personality, and everybody knows who he is. And as soon as I got in the seat, people kind of waited for me to come to them and to prove myself. And as I was, you know, when one of the younger chancellors in the seat, I think a lot of people treated me like I didn't deserve to be here. And I think being a woman and being on the younger side were two things that I really had to struggle with. Mm-hmm. And so if I'm being completely transparent and vulnerable, I think that those are things that I continue to battle every single day. And not battle, but that I have to remind myself, I deserve to be here. I know that I am the best person for this job in this moment. I don't think it's a mistake or a coincidence that Project Open Arms happened and I led that. And here we are supporting immigrant students and families, and they know that I'm their advocate. And I have the added benefit of being a chancellor who has a child in the system, right? And being a mom in the system. So I have to talk to myself all of the time and remind myself how important those roles are and that I am very deserving of being here. And I think that when I think about what's going to happen in the future, it's important for me to feel so secure in this role now, because if I can do this well and with confidence and deliver on my promises for kids and families, and I don't really know what else I can't do.
Mm-hmm.
And I want other women, particularly younger women who are up and coming and don't necessarily have the grades or the breeding or the contacts. I didn't know anybody. I remember coming to Tweed and someone said, "Do you know who that is that was just talking to you?" And I said, "No, but she was so nice." And they're like, "That's Camille Joseph Barlick, and she's about to be the mayor's chief of staff." I said, "Oh, I didn't know." And they're just looking at me like, "What is wrong with you?" So I really had just no contacts. And yet my work brought me here, right? And mm-hmm. So if there's anything that I want other women to realize is that you build courage by acknowledging what you bring to the table, even if it's not defined by society traditionally. And there's no such thing as someone who's perfect or, you know, who fits the profile. Like when we break those molds, that's when we sometimes find the best leadership.
Yes, yes, yes. 1,000 times. Yes. How do you remind yourself of this day in, day out? Is it like, do you have a post-it? Are you like doing a mantra? Are you journaling? Are you talking about it while you're on the subway to yourself?
I journal a lot. I make sure that my social media is protected. So mm-hmm. I don't have a lot of people following me personally, but I follow a lot of really positive people that pour that into me. So when I'm scrolling, like everyone else in America who's addicted to their phones, I'm seeing that positivity. Mm-hmm. I have an amazing partner who listens to me whine about myself, and then he reminds me how wonderful I am and celebrates me. And the most important thing is I look at my daughter, and I don't want her to talk about herself negatively or say that she can't do something because she wasn't born to be something. I want her to see that regardless of our circumstances, we can accomplish what we want for ourselves.
What an incredible role model you are for all
Thank
of that.
Thank you.
So each guest on the podcast nominates another guest. Who do you think we should feature next on the Uplifters podcast?
So I think you should talk to Assemblywoman Catalina Cruz.
Okay.
She is an Assemblywoman from Queens. She is incredible. And I talk about her all the time. When I got into this role, she called me, didn't know who I was, and said, "I'm very nervous about the way the DOE is supporting immigrant families, and I have a lot of ideas and international schools." And she's like, she goes to 100. She is intense. She is brilliant. She's just phenomenal. And really, she could have scared the heck out of me. But I said, "Assemblywoman, you're absolutely right. We need to do more. And this is what I'm mapping out." And just because I acknowledged that, like, we needed to do better, she was like, "Okay." And from there on, we just became super close friends. And she was one of the first people I called to let her know that I was becoming chancellor. She's walking in the street and she's like, "My friend is chancellor. You can't tell you who she is, but she's a chancellor." And this woman, who is a brilliant attorney, who is an accomplished assemblywoman, she never forgets what it is to pour into other women. And she and her chief of staff have created what they call the girl army. And so they will bring all these powerful women together who don't necessarily know each other and say, "Okay, you're a bestie and you're a bestie. Now we're all besties. So now we work together," right? And just this ecosystem of women who love each other, who don't judge each other, but give each other honest feedback, right? Mm-hmm. Because real friendship is about being honest mm-hmm. and not providing an echo chamber.
Mm-hmm.
And she has quite the story because she was a dreamer herself.
Oh my gosh, I can't wait to talk to her. She sounds like total uplifter material, start
She's
to
amazing.
Finish. And I just want to know her and get to hang out with her for 45 minutes.
Yep.
Last question. So as uplifters, we live for uplifting others and supporting the missions of heart-centered women. So how can we best support you and this extraordinary mission you are on, Chancellor?
Thank you so much. I would love it if we could continue to champion literacy, particularly in our most challenged and impoverished communities. I also think that it is so important that we feature some of our young student journalists and young student leaders who are doing such incredible things in their younger years because of the opportunities that we're giving them. So that way, everyone understands that literacy is everyone's responsibility and mm-hmm. everyone's charge, not just the literacy teacher and English teacher. And that people start seeing our young people for the brilliant, hardworking, professional innovators that they are and believing in public education. So I charge everyone with that.
I love it. I love it. I, as a mother of teenage daughters, I am completely dismayed by the bad rap teenagers have gotten. I don't get it at all. I think they are so incredible and inspiring and passionate and hardworking and creative, and they make us such better people. And I'm on a bit of a mission to rebrand teenagers because I think the only reason they start acting out is because we tell them they're going to be awful. And so they
yes.
start.
And they're
being
not engaged.
No, because, right. We're giving them boring, regurgitated stuff that's not interesting to them. Anyway, that's for another day. It was really, really wonderful to meet you.
Oh, it was wonderful to spend time with you. Thank you for having me.
Thank you.
I feel like I'm part of like this amazing society of women to be on the show.
We're the Uplifters Collective.
Yes,
that's what I call us in my brain. Thank you. You are truly an uplifter, and I'm so glad to meet you.
Thank you. Likewise. It's been an honor. Be well.
Thank you for listening to the Uplifters Podcast. If you're getting a boost from these episodes, please share them with the uplifters in your life, and then join us in conversation over at theuplifterspodcast.com. Head over to Spotify, Apple Podcast, or wherever you get your podcast and like, follow, and rate our show. It'll really help us connect with more uplifters, and it'll ensure you never miss one of these beautiful stories. Mwah! Big love.
Painted water sunshine with rosemary and thyme. Dwelling up perplexing, though you find it vexing. Toss a star and hover, be your own best lover. Relish in a new prime, plant a tree in springtime. Dance with idle hindsight, bring the sun to twilight. Lift you up, whoa. 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 Lift you up.
In the pre-chorus,
I was like, "Mommy, stop crying! Mommy, stop crying! You're disturbing the peace."